Great. So welcome, Devin Latrice Keene. We are happy to have you here with us today, and we're going to be talking about your experiences with the Department of Afro-American and African Studies as we celebrate our 50th anniversary, which is going on for quite a while, but that's all good. So we're going to lead off with Ashley Hayes, and she will follow through with some questions for you.
Great.
Yes, thank you. My question is, when did you arrive at U of M as a student and what did you study?
Well, actually, it's pretty significant. This is my 30th anniversary of setting foot on campus. I was 17 years old. I'm 47 this year. So 30 years ago when I was 17, a little baby, I set foot on campus in the residential college as a first generation student. I didn't know that that's what I was. Nobody talked about that in the 90s, from a single parent and back at a time when Ann Arbor was still someplace you could afford to rent in. So my mom was able to make sure we lived in Ann Arbor. And so I started in the residential college and didn't really know what I wanted to major in. I studied abroad in Germany in high school. And so I came right from Germany my senior year college. I was home for a little bit and went right to my orientation at U of M. So that was my first experience. And it was really overwhelming and really exciting time. And I met some of my best friends in the residential college. We lived in East Quad. And so that really set the stage, those friendships that I made and really my involvement in Black Student Union pretty shortly after coming on campus really were, you know, formative.
Thank you. And can you tell us what you studied and can you describe your earliest experiences with the then Center for Afro-American and African Studies?
Sure. So, you know, I ultimately ended up, I was what you called a hidden major because I my declared major was sociology, but I took all my classes were CAS. I mean, majority of my classes were CAS. So in the end, when I went to do my final audit at sociology, they're like, you have a specialization in race and ethnicity. and I didn't do that intentionally. It was just that was all the classes I took. So I took, I'm trying to remember those first classes. I took so many. I mean, the fact that the fact that CAS is interdisciplinary, of course, Nisha's class. I took Caribbean literature. I took Caribbean intellectual thought with Nisha Hanif. It was supposed to be great books of the Caribbean, but she, in Nisha's way, transformed it to, Caribbean intellectual thought. And we read Walter Rodney and Franz Fanon and History of the Guyanese Working People. I went on as a non-traditional student. Even when I came back to finish school, I still took classes that were cross-listed. So I took Social Foundations of Identity and African-American Intellectual Thought. And, you know, so, you know, it really was, you know, it's funny that, you know, the exact classes, not all of them come to mind, but we were always in CAS. I mean, that's where we were physically. It was very closely connected with our time in Black Student Union. We went to all the programming that went there. Evans, so beloved, was our touchstone in the office. And we were always in Hayden. It was when CAS was in West Hall. So we were always in the Hayden Lounge all the time, the library. So I don't know, that really was our home, I think, between Black Student Union and West Hall. I mean, those, and then of course, like, you know, the Fishbowl, which is now where the Haven Hall, where CAS is located now, DES is located now. But yeah, that was ironically, I took Intro to African Studies with Gracia Clark. The funny thing is, I don't think I took 100. I don't think I took that. I don't think I took 111, which I'm like, how did I skip over that? But I took, a lot of other classes. So.
Thank you. And I think you said, I think that you started to get at this a little bit, but I would love to hear more about what you believe to be the importance of an Africana studies program at a predominantly white university for undergraduate students.
Oh, wow. You know, I think this is colored with my, you know, current, you know, my work as a staff and staff person, but as a student, it was everything. I mean, it was, you know, I feel like Black Student Union was my first home. And I think Black Student Union's home was really CAS. So it was like, it's almost like a nesting doll where, you know, there would be no Black Student Union if it wasn't for CAS and student activism. And so it all links. And it gave me a firm sense of belonging. There were people that I met through CAS and through Black Student Union. Multi-generational too, which is really important. Like I was an undergrad, but I came into contact with graduate students, PhD students, when I wouldn't normally. I don't think there would have been any natural mechanism for me to do that if I wasn't connected with CAS and the Black Student Union. And I just remember Angela Davis coming to campus that first year and feeling the strong sense of belonging, especially as someone who grew up in Ann Arbor, which is also predominantly white, where being Black was constructed a certain way and it wasn't constructed the way that I was. So it's like, if you took advanced classes, I think, unfortunately, this is still the case. You know, I was one of four, like there was two of us girls and two boys that were Black that were in accelerated college prep classes in my high school. And so the sense is that you're exceptionalized, you know, you're so different and you're so, you know, all my friends were white and they were really good friends. So I was like, okay, well. And I just remember in that moment, looking around, being surrounded, I went with a group of friends that I'd met through CAS and Black Student Union. And I was like, they're like me. You know what I mean? I just remember having the sense of really, I mean, it kind of brings tears to my eyes, but that sense of like, I can be myself and I can be exactly who I am and I can be smart and I can care about things I care about. And just really, CAS was enabled me to get the knowledge. I mean, Robin D.G. Kelly taught at Michigan at that time. Eduardo Bonilla Silva taught, you know, and these are classes where you're just survey of Afro-American history and race, you know, I forget the other class that was a sociology class as part of the race and ethnicity requirement. Again, that comes, it comes here because of CAS, it's here because of activism, it's here. Like everything that informed my experience and informed my knowledge and understanding of what it is to be Black in America, that just, it just props you up. I mean, it gives you that such a strong foundation that I still draw on today. The 1619 project, like I emailed Robin Kelly and I said, like, everything I know about 1619 is because of your class. Still, everything I understand about why that's important is from what I learned from those classes that I took. And I'm just so grateful. It informs my work now, working diversity, equity, inclusion, like that foundation, that first, that really in-depth exploration and understanding and those questions and those conversations through different events, the Shakespeare, was it the Black Shakespeare Theater? I don't remember if you remember, Beth.
Yes.
But, yeah, but we hung out one night with actors from that, you know, they came and we like hung out and we went and just getting to hear like Black people from Britain, you know what I mean? Like, what's that about? You know, just. And so it was both the curricular, but co-curricular opportunities, the programming, the people, the investment, to the being seen. I think you can really, as a Black student, feel invisible or hyper-visible. It's this weird dichotomy. You're like hyper-visible, but invisible at the same time. Like everybody knows when you're not in class, but no one cares enough to like encourage you to go to grad school. You know what I mean? Like if you're in these classes with predominantly white people, like, oh, you weren't here. And you feel like super stressed out. She's like, oh, that guy wasn't here in class either. But you're not asking him where he was, you know, because he blends in and I don't. So just having that sense of belonging was really important. Just building that really important foundation across multiple disciplines, which I think is just a real, that I could take Intro to African Studies and take Survey of Afro-American History and have that be in the same place, you know, or from the same place, I think is really important. And I did study abroad in Ghana, you know, and so all of that, it all connects, and it's just really been a thread that's run through my whole life.
Thank you for sharing that insightful response. I want to ask another question, then I'll pass it off to Tara. But as a student who was in Ann Arbor Native, is there a relationship that you had, or your family, or your community had, other townies may have also had with U of M?
You know, I mean, I did. I was in the first cohort of the King Chavez Park Scholars Program. I was in eighth grade. So that was my first memory of U of M. And we didn't go to football games or any of those things. I think our church used to like work in sessions for money, but I mean, it requires a level of access, right? Those tickets cost a lot of money. And so I think that, you know, really that was my first experience, like getting to know, in that case, the College of Engineering sponsored that, and staying in a dorm. So when I started here, on campus, there really was a sense of like, I still felt like I traveled somewhere. Like, even though I was still in town, I could still like do my laundry at home. And like, I took my friends home for the Labor Day holiday, you know, because class would always start right before that. It still felt like I had traveled and I was someplace different. And that you know, I always tell people that, like, even if you're from Ann Arbor, it feels like you've traveled somewhere else. And I reflected, and I remember being really angry when I would take classes. I'm like, why didn't I learn this in high school, you know? And I went through, because I save everything, I went through and I found my notebooks for my American culture class from Pioneer High School. And I saw notes where we had learned some of the things that we had learned in Robin Kelly's class about, you know, slavery and enslavement and African Americans, but it didn't stick. And I realized, I remember the day that Professor Kelly was giving a lecture, and he said, you pay attention to this, because this is the most important thing you will ever learn. And that's how he said it. And I was like, you know, it's a difference. It's not just what you're taught, it's how you're taught it, and the importance that it's given, and the relevance that it shares, and how it connects to the rest of the world, and how it connects to the history of this United States and your contribution. So it's not enough. And that's what I think what DAS and CAS brings to the topic. It's not enough that something is taught. It's not just about adding, you know, certain readings to a syllabus, or saying something like, oh, the sky is blue or whatever. Like, it's that, I mean, you're being taught by scholars who are like preeminent. I mean, Robin Kelly is just a super sick, amazing, you know, and a lot of these scholars at that time, they didn't stay at Michigan. And we still have that problem, you know, broadly. And I remember running into him on campus, and I said, Professor Kelly, you're leaving, aren't you? Because I couldn't find him anywhere in this. I was searching to take another class with him. And he said, Devin, Ann Arbor is a hard place for Black people. You know, so it's something that the fact that CAS has been able to continue to do what it does, become a department for 50 years in the face of those kind of barriers, and continue to be a resource for students and for staff and for, you know, faculty and for everyone. It's not inconsequential, because it's not like it was just like a path with no barriers. Like, oh yeah, no big of, like, 50 years of this department and this, you know, from a center to department, given that those kind of larger structural issues, is really important to recognize. So
Devin, thanks again so much. I was interested in following up on one of the things you mentioned with regard to study abroad. I know that you mentioned that you did study abroad as a high schooler in Germany, but then also as a U of M undergrad in Ghana. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that experience with study abroad at UM.
Yeah. So I think my experience in Ghana was, hold on, let me relocate to a little bit quieter place. This guy a little bit. Okay.
Looks like you're running on the spot at that beach.
Running on the sand, if only that level of exercise would be really helpful, probably. Let's see. We're all at my mom's house. Can you hear me well?
Yeah.
So, okay. Get myself situated. All right. To talk about my experience in Ghana, I just have to touch quickly on Germany because I think that informed my choices. So I was 17 when I went to live, no, I was 16 when I went to Germany my senior year. And it was very important and life-changing and difficult, wonderful experience. And when I was in college, I was like, okay, most people go to Europe. I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that again. I mean, it was fine, but I'm ready to do something different. And they had just started this program to Ghana in concert. It was administered by Council for International Educational Exchange out of New York. And so that was really, so it was kind of cool because it was, there was only two other people. So three of us total who came from University of Michigan, but we met up with folks in New York from University of Western Washington University, folks from universities in New York, Philadelphia. So our cohort, and our cohort was predominantly Black, which is not normal. That's not what usually happens. And so, you know, Gracia Clark's work is in Ghana. So that was really helpful to have had that background. But the, still, like most of my work had been my research and my, not my research, but my classes at DAS have been really focused on the African-American experience. And so to go to Ghana, I remember I didn't really know about the slave castles before I went. So it's almost like the other half of my education was filled out. And I remember they said to us, you know, we're going to go to Cape Coast Castle. And I'm like, okay, you know. And they said, oh, you know, you're going to cry. When they go, you're going to cry. I'm like, I'll be fine. Like, I didn't really realize. And then when we got to the dungeons, slave castles, and we were waiting for the tour to start, I went into one room and just really felt, I just started shaking and feeling very unsettled and very upset, and didn't know why. And then when the tour started, found out that was the room, an isolation room where they put rebellious Africans and then they would starve them. And that's the room they left them in. And so it just opened up a whole nother layer to my spiritual understanding. Just, you know, I don't know if it's because we're on the equator. I'm not saying that Ghana's supernatural. You know, I'm just saying that it's just, you know, I took, you know, a class called The Social Structure of Ghana. We took a class learning some tree understanding. There was so much that was familiar about the way children were raised and some of the proverbs and the saying felt very familiar to me in a way that, yes, we can say, yes, I've got, I know I'm quintessentially American. And I understand that, and I understand that I have European blood that runs through my veins. But it, when you're there, like when I was in Germany, there was nothing that I encountered other than English being a Germanic language that made me feel like, oh, this reminds me of home. Whereas so many things in Ghana reminded me of my upbringing and my family and the way that we, you know, did things. So it was, you know, I knew I stayed for a whole year. And I did that because I understood after living in Germany for a year that after about a semester, you're just starting to figure out things and then you go home. So that's why I did a year, because I was like, well, I know I'm going to need some extra time to really deepen my understanding of the culture. I will say that when I came back, I was with my mom in the car one time and I put my hands on top of my head, both my hands on top of my head, you know, to rest. I just wanted to see what she was going to say. And she said, don't do that. And I said, why? She's like, I don't know. My grandma used to say it's bad luck. Well, in Ghana, that's a sign of deep mourning. When there's funerals, people put both hands on top of their heads as a sign of extreme grief. And it was just amazing that my mom asked, you know, and it wasn't pre-med, like I just, and my mom said that, and she's like, my grandma said it was bad luck. So just, you know, just that connection, my father, who's from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, originally from St. Kitts, I talked about Anansi stories and he said, what do you know about Anansi stories? They tell those stories in the bush back home. Like, what do you know about Anansi stories? And I said, Dad, those are from Ghana. You know, so it just really, it kind of completed, and just that sense of being able to return to a land that our ancestors, that our ancestors never thought they'd return to, and to, in some way, shape, or form, bringing their blood and themselves back here hundreds and hundreds of years later, was really profound, you know, that sense. And when I was in South Africa years later with the study abroad program, being separated from my kids, I was, you know, there for 7 weeks, and it was a wonderful experience of the staff. But I thought, wow, I'm having so much difficulty being away from my children for 7 weeks. Imagine being across the waters and leaving and not ever being, like, I just, I feel like, again, it connects me back to that moment in Ghana of, like, you know, because we didn't have, you know, there was no, like, WhatsApp or Skype or, you know, so, you know, they're little kids, you can't really have a conversation with children with the delay and everything. So it was kind of being, like, cut off from them. And again, taking it back to those, that thought, and just the scholarship that's able to happen in Ghana and even South Africa, like, without the kind of wide open access to resources that we have here, you're just like, people are just brilliant. You know what I mean? They're brilliant anyway, but, you know, similar to how Cass is able to do so much under so many structural constraints and racism and bias and all that institutional wise, I think it really mirrors the type of brilliance and the significance of the work that happens on the continent with those very same, you know, constraints. So sorry, I know I give long answers to short questions.
No, that's great. Thanks for sharing so generously, you know, these very moving experiences. So kind of building on that, how do you think that study abroad in Ghana during your undergraduate impacted your life and work, you know, sort of sense of commitment, etc.
You know,
sense of self. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, in all the ways I've described, but I think also, like, it's really important to be a stranger in a strange land. I mean, I think it gives you an empathy and a perspective that just cannot be replicated. I mean, you can have some somewhat similar experiences by moving to a new town. I'm gonna grab my charger. But, you know, that just sense of, like, having no idea. Like, I remember saying, it takes so long to get things done here. And my Ghanaian friend said, no, it takes you a long time to get things done here because you're not from here. You don't know how to do it. So grab my, let's hope, there we go. I was like, let's pray my charger is here. It is. So, you know, that I think is really important. Let me just pause 1 second. I'm going to get set up before my laptop dies.
Okay. Sure, take your time.
All right, we are set, locked and loaded. So I think that's one thing, is that empathy. We have a large, you know, the unit where I work with now, we have a large number of international students. When I worked at the African Studies Center, yeah, visiting scholars, and then as part of the Moody program, the precursor to the African Studies Exchange program, you know, you're always welcoming people. And I think it's just really important to not make assumptions and to understand, like, what people might not understand. And I think that also impacts my work in student affairs and any interaction with students, because really, University of Michigan, we did this once for a welcome orientation. I asked my colleague, I said, can you do some research to see what countries have a population that are either equivalent or about the same as, or equal or less to the School of Information, I mean, the University of Michigan. Because if you think about it, we have what? I think in the end it's 70,000 when you count, like, staff and faculty and everything. And we're like, okay, here's a list of countries that have that population. So the idea is that University of Michigan is like a country. And so when people are coming in, each department's like a different region. And so, like, understanding that people are having to figure so much out, like, what's the language or what's the dialect? You know, what are the cultural norms? What are the, and And that it's not automatic that you'll know those things or understand. So I think that has informed it. You know, just the sense of like helping, and this also is a little bit my work with African Studies Center, but it's like so many people come to help. There's this idea of helping. We're gonna go help. You know, I was like, who asked you? You know, did someone ask for help? You know, did someone ask for help? Did they, what are they doing already there? What might you join in on? Are you an asset at all or not? Like this assumption, this really arrogance that we have as Americans about that we're going to be able to help. And so often we hinder. So I think that perspective and the humbleness that it brings you when you're like, I have no problem being laughed at. Like, you know, you get laughed at all the time when you're a stranger in a stranger. Like you say the wrong thing in German, or you say, you know, when I was laughing, when we were in Ghana, I said that you will die of thirst if you ask for water. No Americans, rah, rah, water, rah, right? I said, so give me some water. And they'd be like, aha, and then nothing. They'd be like, okay, I'm speaking English and you're speaking English, so why am I not getting any water? And so then you know, we figured out, you ask for water. You ask for water, you'll get water. But if you ask for water, you're not gonna get anything, you know? So this, you know, we had a friend who figured this out right away, and we're like, why is she talking like that, you know? She was just smarter than we are. She kind of was really observant and figured it out. So by the time I left Ghana, we were talking like this, when we wanted to get something, this is how we would talk. It came naturally. This is how we talked to, you know? And the rhythm of talking, that's, you know, that's just it. And that idea that does that sense of like, it's a perfect example. You're like, you're speaking English and I'm speaking English, so why aren't we? But it's like, well, we're actually not speaking the same English, and our way of speaking is not necessarily. And they called me white when I was in Ghana. I said, can you teach me some words, some tree? And he says, oh, I will call you Obruni Koko. And I said, oh, what does that mean? He said, oh, that means white woman. I was like, oh, what do you mean? I'm not white. And I wasn't offended. Some people were really hurt by that, but you know, he put something, one time someone put their hand next to mine and I said, I'm not white, or Minye Obruni. They said, Koko Tum Tum, which is another, they said, you know, it's basically red bone is what they were saying. They were saying Tum Tum is black and Koko is red. So they put it to my skin and said, you're red and I'm black. So, you know, all of those experiences, but you do have people who come up to you and are like, welcome, sister, long lost sister, you know, tell you stories about, you know, people being tricked onto slave ships and taken on slave ships to perform, but then being, you know, the ships going out to sea. And there was a woman from the Volta region who shared that story that had been passed on for generations. So all of that is, you know, I think it really, again, just that perspective bringing.
That's very interesting in terms of what you described, the mix of finding common ground and also navigating surprises and differences.
Yeah, and I said, I mean, I told one person, I call those one of those God moments, you know, when you're kind of channeling the ancestors, and he said, how can you be, again, he called me Obruni, and I said, Minye Obruni, Minye Obruni, I'm not white, I'm black. And he said to me, how can you be black when you have the eyes of a white man? And I said, you know, there's going to be many of us who are going to return and we're going to look all kinds of ways. Our skin's going to be all different colors and our eyes will be all different colors in our hair. But if we come to you and we say that this is our home and this is where we came from, believe us. You know, it was this really very intense moment with this gentleman. And I met with people who said, they met me and they immediately said, oh, we didn't do the slave trade. Oh, it wasn't us. It was the Arabs. It wasn't us. It was the Arabs. And I was like, yeah, it was you too. You know, I mean, the Shanti are great traders. I mean, they're traders, they're business people. And I was like, that was the business of the day. So I don't have anger or resentment, but we're just gonna deal with facts. Yes, the Arabs were involved in the slave trade, but it wasn't just them, you know, that, you know, they called Ghana the white man's graveyard. So they wouldn't be able to get much done if it wasn't facilitated or in some way. So again, that's all, you know, part of understanding history and understanding facts and recognizing the emotional impact, but also just like we're all victims, you know, victims of colonialism, victims of economy and you know, however, the whatever money was made wasn't, was it really worth the trade, you know?
Mm-hmm. Beth, you want to go ahead with the next set?
Absolutely. So we're moving now, Devin, into the era when I got the opportunity to work with you. And so we're interested in finding out about your experience as a staff person working at DAS. So can you kind of describe your entry into DAS? When did it happen? And why did you choose this center to come work? Why was that something that interested you?
Wow, so that was 2002. So I had been working, again, I had stopped out of school and had my two children and finally was able to finish. I took a sabbatical from my job and I was working at a pharmaceutical company. So my first professional job was as administrative assistant and at Pfizer, well, Park Davis and then Pfizer. I mean, we all know because many of us have been vaccinated, most are vaccinated. And I worked for drug safety, ironically, at one point, regulatory affairs and drug safety. And so when I left, I was like, okay, so now I finished school and I finished when I was 27, 28. And I was like, okay, I'm ready for a role and a position opened up. I think I might've been talking to you, Beth, and you said, I think there might be a position that might be opening up. And so I applied. And I had really, at that time, you know, had been off for a year. And so I'd been able to spend time with my children in a way. I hadn't been able to like go on field trips and be available. And that was really important to me to be part of a place that was family oriented and, you know, that I could bring my whole self to. I loved CAS. So that was it was just like, I couldn't think of a better opportunity to combine both my skill set and, you know, as administrative professional, which, you know, we always worked at a very high level at, you know, Pfizer, but in an environment that just like fed my soul. And so you just, you know, getting to work with Beth was also like, wow, I get to work with Beth. That's be amazing. And she was you were Beth, such an incredible mentor to me and friend and, you know, working with the South Africa Initiatives Office, you know, and doing the kind of programming. I still think of those initial, you know, some of those programs we had early on. I mean, and so it's like, I just realized my first real experience with transferable skills, you know, so I'm doing some of the things that I did to like plan travel for FDA meetings. And this time I'm planning travel for amazing speakers who are, you know, and I get to help set up and be present for these, you know, let's say Kusundiata, was that who, mm-hmm. I even was referencing him the other day, the blessing of the boats, right?
Yes.
And that was, I mean, God, when was that? That was back, you know, 2002, 2003, 2004. And I remember him saying, I said, where's your, of all the places you've traveled, what's your favorite place to travel? And he said, my imagination. And he said, you know, these days, all the technology, I think, is designed to take people away from their imagination, from themselves. And that resonates with me so much still today, as we've gotten more and more immersed and more ways to be distracted. And so, you know, that just goes to show, I still remember that. It's so very salient to me all these years later. So that was just, it was just, like I said, my soul was fed. And I remember my mom saying, you know, I think it mattered too, that we had the staff were, you know, predominantly Black. And my mom said, we're so used to working in places where, especially at Pfizer, you know, where you're one of few, like if two Black people are talking or three Black people are talking, people are like, what's going on? What's happening? Why? What's happening? You know, there's like this, you know, you're just so very hyper-visible, similar to being a student at U of M. And I remember my mom saying, when she was trying to understand who I worked with, she's like, okay, are they Black? And I was like, mm-hmm. Okay, was that person Black? I said, mom, we're all Black. You know, most of us are Black. So, you know, and that was edifying, you know, and I think that we are also highly skilled. It wasn't, you know, I don't even need to, it goes without saying, so I'm not even going to say it, that everyone worked at a really high level. I'm learning in this class I'm taking now how much energy we spend trying to counter common narratives about Blackness.
Yes. Yep.
And so, you know, I'm intentionally not going to talk about how qualified we were. Even though I kind of, because I think there's a sense of like, oh, there must be something. And like, no, like no one questions when a department's all white. or all white and all female. I mean, so much of higher ed is you know, are white women, and no one questions that, you know? So I'm going to say that, you know, there was, it was just amazing to work at such a high level with, you know, around areas of passion. And Ahmed Kathrada, I was talking about him the other day, mm-hmm. You know, the most precious, humble, loving person. And, you know, George Lamming, right? You know, yeah. and you know, and you're like driving them in your car to like take them somewhere. And I remember Kathrada saying, "Oh, I see the small children don't have cell phones. That's so great. Like in South Africa, even like little 9-year-olds have cell phones." And back then, I mean, now you see that here, but you didn't see that then, you know? And
right.
So it's just the blessing of my life. I mean, truly was, I mean, just, yeah.
Yeah, I tell you, it ties in with the other question I have about the particular culture that you find within CAS at that time, moving into DAS, that then led toward our creation, the creation of the African Studies Center. Could you speak a little bit about some of the unique qualities that you found in CAS since you've left it, you know, other places that you've gone and worked? What did you find within DAS that would be considered that gave you that sense of, you know, empowerment?
Well, I think there's a greater purpose. I mean, I think we're very aware as a staff. I think for all of us, it was more than a job. You know, it was part of the our work. It's something we were personally committed to, and we had been committed to for a long time. So it, like I said, there's a through line to my time as a student. And so you understand the greater significance of what CAS is about and how it came to be about. So it's never divorced from its origins, and then how it's continued to be a place for Black students. So that connection, so being able to connect with students and whether they were majors or not, you know what I mean? I think that's something I feel like in other places, it's like, I don't know that people who were not, didn't have degrees in information science or didn't have degrees in like, whatever, political science, like, I don't think they'd be hanging around those departments. Like, I went to sociology department because I needed to get my audit done. But other than that, I was always in CAS. You know, I was like, okay, why? It was very transactional, like nothing against sociology. But, you know, I went there to get like sort of check all the check boxes to do the things I needed to do. But I went to CAS as my home. And I think as a staff person, like it was never just a job. We were always very aware of like our purpose and our meaning. And again, it was connected to a greater work. And it was, you could see that outside of that. And like the way, the things we were engaged in outside of work, we cared deeply about one another as colleagues and provided support in ways. And also like, honestly, even after I left CAS, like when horrible things happened in the world, like I would come into the office and I would go to CAS. I'm like, I need to, you know, I was working at the International Institute, and I forget, I mean, any number of things that have happened over the years, but, and I know Beth, I'm sure Beth remembers, like, I would just come into her office and I would come back to DAS, and I was like, I need to be around people who understand how I'm feeling and where I know we received, because in other departments, people wouldn't even say anything about it. I mean, people act like George Floyd, they're like, you know, like, there's this whole thing, and I was like, I mourned as deeply and as greatly for every death before George Floyd and every death after. So I understand that the world figured something out that day, but it wasn't anything different. Like, you know, so then other days, you know, pre-George Floyd, I'm sitting in my office and I was like, do-do-do-do-do, how's the weather? Like, no one, it's like nothing happened. I wanted to just take black paint and just like put it on my face as like visible sign of mourning, and I'll be at my desk, but can we show something to show something that happened? So I would leave and I would come to, you know, my home. I would go to DAS to feel that. And I think it continues to be that place. And you know, being part of the 50th anniversary advisory board, and that was the last time I saw Evans. Gosh, I'm just crying so much in this stupid video. So not stupid, you know what I mean? It's okay. You know, that's the last time I saw Evans. And I was so filled up when I went that day to see so many people I loved, you know, and so many people that were part of my journey and that were my professors. It's almost like your cells are inflated, you know, like the energy that you get from being in the room with people that are just like titans who like started African study programs. And, you know, it's just that through line through history, and that you're all linked through this place in really powerful ways that are so deeply connected to our place in this society, in this country. It's all connected. And it was the just a beautiful time to be there. Mm-hmm. And that's such a special place.
Yeah, I think about what you were saying. I absolutely can recall moments where that sense of empathy just flows through the halls. I remember the day of 9/11, we were still in West Hall. And I remember, you know, we were coming up the stairs, and at that time, School of Information was always so technologically advanced. They had monitors set up in the hallways, and we saw, you know, the first building strike, and Kelly Askew was coming up the stairs, who's now a chair of anthropology. And, you know, she collapsed into my arms, and we just held each other because we didn't know how to react to something that seemed unbelievable. It was like watching, you know, some kind of movie before our eyes, but we were processing that it was reality. And I think that after that, everybody just swept together and just tried to gather to get a sense of just some connection to other human beings. And I do feel that that's something that DAS definitely has been able to maintain over the years, despite wherever our location was, even from when I was a student to now at the present. You know, it's still, people check in all the time, just like, how are you doing out there? And it's like DAS has become like a diaspora in and of itself, with all of us separated and scattered, but it's such a beautiful thing. So I totally hear what you're saying in terms of, you know, that whole feeling.
And I didn't realize Kelly was the new chair of Anthro. She is?
Yes, yes. It's amazing. Dassey's on the move. It's just always incredible to see the progress that it's made across, you know, that comes from the roots that, you know, I just so proud. But speaking of Kelly, I wanted to talk a little bit about your involvement with the African Studies Center, and how that for you as a staff person, you know, moving into something where now you were helping to create a new venue within the university that was tied to something that was DAS related, but now it was taking off on its own. It was just around the time that we were just on the ebb of becoming a department, and the African Studies Center was coming into fruition. So could you speak just a little about that to us?
Yeah, you know, I've always been in the fortunate position where I've gone into new roles, I've always been in a really good place in my previous one. So I was never fleeing, you know, I was never like, oh my God, you know. And when this opportunity came up, I was like, if not this, what? Because I love DAS, I mean, I love CAS, and I love the faculty, and I've got these relationships, and this way I can maintain those relationships. You know, so I get to keep working with the same people I'm working with in this other, you know, capacity. And so that was the first thing that was so amazing, and getting to work with Kelly, who, you know, I'd been working with, obviously not as closely. And also being able to, with Kelly being the director and being the program manager, it's like we both had those connections. So it was really important to us to give CAS its due and not to be like, we were always very clear. We're not, you know, DAS is the curricular home of African studies and African American studies and Caribbean studies. And we are here to help facilitate build on the work that already started there. And so I think we were able to, in a way that I don't know if someone else, other folks would have been able to do. I think we were very careful to do that. And it was really important to us to do that. And so that, again, that foundation really of relationships building and just that orientation, the study abroad and all the things I've talked about really informed the work. And then, you know, being able to do it at an even greater level, I think we always had great ideas and in some ways, in many ways, we're able to implement those ideas in CAS. But here with a brand new center just starting, I realized, wow, a big part of my job is to think. You know, I was so used to doing, and it's like, you know, now I have to do, but also just think about how we're going to do this and strategically think. And it was a level of opportunity. I remember Beth gave me this, you know, beautiful book. And I remember she said, nothing changes if nothing changes, you know, and so it did feel really daunting, but being able to still work with Lester Motz and then being able to work with faculty across humanities, social science, you know, STEM, and all these humanities, all these different groups. It was, again, the interdisciplinary aspect of it was what was so fulfilling. So any given day, I could be talking about like archives in Uganda, and like the next day I could be talking about like overfishing and international fishing in waters and how that affects like coastal regions of Africa. Like, you know, like from day to day. And so that's like, you're never bored. It's really exciting. You get to meet, again, delegations from across the continent and still get to connecting with scholars. So that was really, really just amazing. And it was so overwhelming. In the beginning, we were kind of shaping how we would ultimately go. We had our key initiatives, but you know, the president's office wasn't hosting these delegations from Bahadur University, where they were like, okay, African studies, you do it. I was like, okay, that's how do you host a whole delegation from, you know, or the African Union, folks from the African Union. These, you know, we had a big conference where the head of the World Bank for Africa region, World Bank, Mokhtar Diop, came. And so, you know, Desmond Tutu was co-hosted. And you're like, this is my job? Like, this is amazing. You know, you're like, I told the student in the elevator, because we, you know, Desmond Tutu was on the elevator, Bishop Tutu was in the elevator with us. And the student got on the elevator, and then we got off the elevator. And I stayed back and I said to the student, you need to understand that you were just in the elevator with Bishop Desmond Tutu. Do you know who that is? They said, no. I said, look him up, Desmond Tutu. It's like being in the elevator with Martin Luther King. That's it. I was like, you just need, I said, I would want someone to tell me if that was me. So I want you, I was really serious. I looked at my eyes. I'm like, look it up. You need to know that you just shared space with this person.
You just gave a Robin DG Kelly moment. Like, like, you need to know. This
you need to know. Important. The most important thing. You need to know. Yeah, exactly. You know, because it was, he's just hilarious, isn't he?
Oh. It was amazing. It was amazing.
He's so funny.
So funny.
I once met him as at a petrol station in Cape Town, Bishop Tutu. And I was shocked. I just looked across and there he was. So I said, hi, Bishop Tutu. How are you? And he said, oh, I'm very well, thanks, my dear. How are you?
Oh my, you're like, can I take a picture?
My God. That's what, I mean, when I think about memories like that, it's just, how do you even describe that? You know, I remember when they had the big, you know, the gathering that evening, and everybody was looking for him. He had come and sat back at the table with me, and he was like, oh, can I hang out with you all here? I'm kind of tired of all these folks. And I was like, oh, gosh, do you know how many people are looking for you right now? And he said, oh, it's all right. I'll just have a little glass of wine back here with you. And it was just one of those moments you were left speechless. But those are the types of things that are afforded by working in areas where you love what you do.
Exactly. And then there's, of course, the time that Beth and I pushed a cart through the snow from West Hall to Haven Hall. We were trying to move. I don't know why movers didn't move this part, but we somehow got left with moving things from West Hall to Haven Hall through the snow on like a library cart.
On a library cart. I mean, it was like you went from these lofty moments to, okay, wait a minute, I'm doing maintenance work. I mean, Nisha looks, she's like, Elizabeth, you go from the garbage lady to giving speeches all within a day. And
I know, a lot of food service, a lot of cleaning up food, putting food away. People need to clean up after them. Well, this will be on record. No matter how high you are administratively, you need to throw away your plate.
Yes.
Leave it on the table. These are all home training basic things. Yeah, so yeah. It's all good fun.
Oh my goodness. So Tara, I'll let you ask some questions about experiences with study abroad as a staff member.
Sure. So Devin, part of my work with DAS as a GSRA is looking into a research project on the history of study abroad at DAS. So that's why I'm also asking you all these questions about study abroad. So when you were a staff member at DAS, what were the study abroad programs you were involved in, and how did it perhaps differ being a staff member from your student experiences?
Yeah, so it was amazing. I think before I went, I think I helped, Beth might help me clarify, but I know we helped after when Lori, I helped put together some of the course materials and the course pack and help facilitate some of the application process. I think I was involved in that part with Beth. Mm-hmm. And then I had the opportunity to travel there when Mamadou went. I think the most thing is that was different is, well, first of all, I had never been to South Africa. So there was that part where I was learning, and a lot of the preparation I underwent with that preparation as well. And that different responsibility, that sense of wanting to treat students like adults, because they were adults, but then also realizing they were emerging adults. So sometimes I ended up talking to them like they were my kids, because that was sometimes most effective. Get in the car, I remember cooking, meals together and students like not knowing maybe how to cut a tomato or something. They're like 19. I'm like, okay, let's show you how to cut a tomato. So just great times, and just trying to facilitate their experience, make sure they still stayed safe and aware, and having that experience of doing study abroad myself, things mean different, different ways of being have different meanings depending where you're at. So like, for example, my sister lived in Ethiopia and in the north, Gondor. And if you wear big earrings, if a woman wears big earrings, that means something particular. Whereas it doesn't mean something that same to us, right? So you have to kind of learn these signals. And I think, just trying to impress upon students like different cultural contexts. I think in South Africa, our group had a lot of biracial students, multiracial students. And so they may present a certain way in South Africa, different than here. And so like, even I experienced that, for me, and it was different than Ghana, right? Because in Ghana, I was called white. South Africa, I'd be identified maybe as a different classification. So depending on where you move, where you're moving. So it's many layers of understanding that there are, you don't know what you don't know. And so just kind of really emphasizing to student that be observant, be ask questions, like be polite, be respectful. And they were great students. But it was different. It was so interesting to be on the other end of it. Instead of being the student that was on the study abroad, you're like the staff trying to facilitate and support that experience. It was, South Africa, was so, my only experience in on the continent had been Ghana, which, was West Africa, very different. And you didn't really see that at the time, the 90s, when I was there in Ghana, you didn't see that many white people, really. If you went to Ivory Coast, you did. So this idea of being in a place where, Europeans had settled and had been living for generations, and knowing the history of apartheid, and, it's some ways very similar to the United States in some ways, but also very different. They're making very different choices than the United States made, and also following in U.S.'s footsteps in other complicated, disturbing ways. So it just felt very, it was more complicated. I feel like Ghana felt more simple, whereas, South Africa felt more complicated because there was enough that was familiar. But that was just really enlightening. I mean, having experiences talking to Catherine Burns, and her father worked in the gold mines, and my ancestors worked in the coal mines of West Virginia. I mean, and my, you know, great grandfather died in a coal mining accident, you know, and her father was injured in a mining accident. And so seeing these points of connection with people you wouldn't, whereas in Ghana, it was this very familiar of like, oh, they have same like sort of culture in some ways, but just realizing that there's these shared experiences across like a white woman from South Africa and a Black woman from America, but having this commonality with mining and families being exploited through, through work, that was just really profound for me. And it was just beautiful. And in Durban, which is the largest population of Indians outside of India, right? So then you're like, I'm in Africa, but I kind of feel like I'm in India too. Like, you know, it was just as profound, and continue to learn so much from that experience, even as you are trying to facilitate that experience for students. And just, again, really value the lectures that we went to, the experiences that were organized by our partners. Really, again, the idea of partnership, mutually beneficial partnership, really important. That has informed all of my work. I mean, I've done a lot of work in outreach at the School of Information, absolutely defined by my time in African studies and CAS, about what collaborative, mutually beneficial partnership, being really transparent about inequities and how we're trying to mitigate those, having that really be open conversations, and understanding that, like, just because you have the money on one end doesn't mean you have all the resources, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, linked to that, are there any particular activities or experiences you remember doing on those study abroad trips, such as the South Africa one, that sort of stuck with you, for instance, that exemplified kind of mutual collaboration with community partners or South African partners or something?
I feel like the way we organized the trip, I mean, I think the way we engage with partners, one example I remember was we were doing lots of email to communicate. At one point, we didn't hear back from folks for a while or whatever. And like, you know, let's call, you know, we're such email culture here. Like, well, you know, they're not responding to our email, you know. And, you know, when we called, we found out the internet had gone out. You know what I mean? So this whole idea of like assuming, like, you know, so just the way it was, you know, coordinated, and the collaborative way, like the agenda and the itinerary was organized. I remember visiting the archives in Durban.
Kelly Campbell, yes, Library.
Good job, Devin. I remembered some part of it enough so that you know what I was talking about. Visiting the archives. I remember Bukile giving a lecture. Catherine, you know, talking. So I just think that, you know, there wasn't any particular, I mean, I remember the lectures, I remember going to the, we went to the YMCA and they were doing the competition that kind of goes all night. What was that? Sorry, my nephew just came. But it was the mix of like the academic lectures with like the experiential part that was really important. And then,
all the performances you're speaking of.
Yeah.
We went all night. It was these beautiful groups that would sing and perform, and it went all night long. So it was kind of like we were thinking, oh, this is going to be like a talent show, but it was so much more, so powerful. And you just found yourself connecting on a level where it was like, more than like a gospel, you know, revival. It was something where the whole, the cultural bearing of the clothing, the music, the dance, all of that. We just left there, you know, any other time I'd leave at 4 or 5 in the morning, I am beat up. But I left there feeling uplifted and just so overjoyed that the culture was continuing this strong tradition of performance.
And they talked to us about that. I mean, to have that's what's so important, is to have our experiences, the students' experience and the staff experience, informed by the knowledge, that context of understanding the significance of the clothing. And I forget, there was a name of, and I cannot, it's failing me, the name of this type of dance and these competitions, but it wasn't like a touristy thing. I think we were the only tourists there.
Mm-hmm.
But the significance of clothing and just knowing those, how that connected to African Americans and the significance of clothing.
Because it was almost like zoot suits. They were very elaborate, beautiful suits, and the ladies' dresses were just phenomenal. And it
I know what you mean. I'm also forgetting the name of it.
Yeah, right. But it's like you weren't, the idea of like having yourself be so policed that you weren't allowed to wear certain clothes and
public
or even the hair. And so that the reaction to that being like that being a part, a sign of you know, agency and a sign of independence and a sign of freedom. Is you know, being able to choose what you wear and to dress up, and it just makes me think about, you know, New Orleans and other places where Black women were forced to cover their hair, and how we turn that into an art form, you know. So I don't know if that gets fully to your question, but it really was that combination. Like it wouldn't have been as rich if you didn't have the readings that preceded it. I mean, I think one of the things we made it very like academic, I think, and I think some of the feedback is like, you know, maybe a little bit less, you know, or have a paper be due like after returning, or give some more space to students because it was a lot. But I think it wasn't, you know, you have to recalibrate, but I think it was our intent was good. And I think the idea that it's, you know, it's that there is to inform perspective. I mean, I remember a lecture specifically about indentured servitude and like how the British justified and how they tried to explain that you know, indentured servitude or bringing Indians into South Africa was different than slavery, and why they had to kind of make that case. And I remember having this really profound moment when learning that one of the ways in which they proved or were saying, hey, this isn't slavery, is that we are not compelling women to work, that women are still quote not owned, but you know what I mean, that they belong to their husbands and fathers and they cannot be compelled to work, so therefore it's not slavery. And as a Black woman realizing, wow, so really fundamentally the definition of slavery is me working, is Black women being compelled to work. And so that I remember was just really, I think I wrote at least one poem about it. I mean, it was just this idea like, wow, when it comes down to it, that when they're trying to defend and say this isn't slavery, it came down to the women and whether women could be compelled to work by an outside force or not. And so that was really something that really stayed with me, just in terms of my conception of myself as a Black woman and how that's been constructed globally, and not just in the American context, but you know, what that means in a international, you know, Pan-African context.
Thanks. I'll turn over to Ashley to lead us in the final stretch.
Yes, so I think your answer to this question may have been sprinkled in throughout your other responses, but from your perspective, how did DASH shape your work and your understanding of the functions of African-American studies as a large part of your education?
Sorry, I got a ding from work. I just looked at it real quick. So yeah, I think I have, you know, sprinkled this throughout. I will just reiterate that the idea of what partnership is, what that means, intentionality around relationship building, that being in it for the long haul. I mean, I think Tim Johnson's work in the obstetrics gynecology department was really stands out as an exemplar in this as well. I mean, he was very clear. He's been working in Ghana since the 80s, and he said, I will only work in Ghana. And they built up their obstetrics gynecology program. They, you know, U of M students did rotations in Ghana, and Ghanaian students did rotations in U of M. And it's been like so many other programs have been modeled on that, and that it's okay to go to deepen that relationship building is so important. I think about the relationships we formed with our colleagues and partners in South Africa. That's been ongoing from, you know, at least from Dr. Moody, if not before. You know, I think people often look for the new shiny thing. And I've been criticized in my outreach work that, you know, we should be go further, faster, we should be doing more. And I very much pushed back against that and said, what do you mean more? You know, there is a long history of U of M doing hit and runs, you know, coming into places and extracting knowledge, extracting experience and extracting whatever, and then moving on for their own, you know, benefit. And I don't see any benefit from that. Like, you know, you build trust by you keep showing up and you keep going back and you act with integrity and authenticity and in ways that promote mutually beneficial partnership. Mm-hmm. And you're not just talking, you're hearing too. Mm-hmm. And that absolutely, yes, it comes from also the way I was raised, but it comes from, it's informed from all my work, you know, and my time in CAS as a student, you know, in history, in the time of the African studies, it's all like that's how that I, and I say that when I give talks or when I say anything, is that my work is deeply informed by my time at, you know, in CAS and now DAS and the African Studies Center. And it's, and that's how I structure outreach. And I, you know, if I was any place that didn't sort of align with that, then I wouldn't not want to be working there.
Yeah, that's such a good point. When you said that, and what you had just said previously about the Pan-African, the sense of collectivism, the sense of relationship building is something that is so important and crucial to real holistic education.
Yep.
That sometimes in our effort to be bigger, better, building this grand thing, we forget that along the way to build these foundational relationships and the networks that create Anansi's spider web, you know, these are the things that hold us together and stand firm when we have crises.
Yeah.
And when we have, you know, situations like even the pandemic, you know, it's things we have no way of ever calculating or predicting what the world will bring us, but we can know how we want to react to it. So finding your inner truth and maintaining it is really something pretty incredible.
It is. And I remember who's our dear friend from Japan?
Akiko.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I remember Akiko emailing, you know, communicating after the tsunami, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her saying, and it stuck with me with this pandemic because I think it's very much true, is that the big box stores and the multinational corporations and the, you know, like the Paneras and those things, they were not the ones who were helpful. It was the mom and pop grocery stores that helped keep people fed and their needs during times of crisis. And it just breaks my heart when I see the small local businesses that have gone out of business because of COVID. Because when it comes down to it, you know, even now when you think about the ways in which local businesses have continued to support communities during this time, and it made me think about Akiko, you know, sharing her experiences in Japan. And, you know, my daughter went back to school today and I was like, you know what, the fact that she's been out of school for a year and is just going back into the building, that's an experience she's sharing with children all over the world. How many things do you have that have affected every single person in the world? You know, this is a profound moment of connection that we can have where, you know, parents vacillating, how do we keep my children safe? Should I go back? Should I, you know, all of those school districts wrestling with this question, you know, and I think the ways in which racism gets in the way of so much and how CAS is working to raise awareness so that we can be in positions of influence and power and policy making so we can bring that information to bear. I think about how, when they told us we didn't have to wear masks, remember? Mm-hmm. I'm like, how could they even fix their mouths to tell us that we shouldn't be wearing masks when they were wearing masks all in Asia? What, Asian scientists, if Chinese scientists don't know what they're talking about, somehow American scientists know more? You know, why, if they've been wearing masks in Germany and France and Italy, I bet we would have been wearing masks, right? So this idea of like who we listen to and who we don't, like that delay, that could have saved lives. But as our arrogance to think that we somehow know more because of what, you know? Right. And so it's to our detriment. Racism is to our, you know, communal detriment. And these sort of institutionalized percent that people are largely unconscious of, and the training you get through CAS and through liberal arts education is to think critically and to understand those things, so that when you're in all these different areas, I mean, people go from DAS to all kinds of fields, you know, like I'm working in the School of Information. Like that's, I didn't know what that was, you know, it wasn't what it is now. It was a different type of school then. And, but, you know, we have folks, we know all over the world, who, you know, we follow folks who were on those study abroad programs.
Mm-hmm.
And they are impacting policy. They are writing policy. They are in communities. They are in businesses. They're in organizations. And they're able to bring that wisdom and that perspective in all these different areas and leverage that and deploy that in ways that really do position us to not keep making these same like archaic mistakes in new and frightening futuristic ways. We're like making it's like this weird dichotomy, right? We're making these archaic, really fumbling mistakes, but using leveraging technology so they're done. The format changes.
Right.
Thank you for that. And our last question for you is, from your experiences, from your first experiences with DAS to where we are today, and since you serve on the 50th Anniversary Advisory Board, how do you envision our next 50 years?
Oh, wow. Visioning. That's so important. Thank you for that question. I think it's so important. I probably don't vision enough. I vision in shorter term, but not longer term. So my vision, and I'll make it a little bit personal, is like, to me, CAS is the example of what, for example, my work at the School of Information, like I want us to open up, I want a student coming to the School of Information to open up the course guide and to see the type of classes that are offered at CAS, or have classes cross-listed. The School of Information and DAS. You know, I think that, I just think that there needs to be classes cross-listed with computer science and DAS. Like, you know, I think that interdisciplinarity has been so important. And I think I could see it really thinking about that Anansi spider web, like spreading forth even more and seeing the expertise that's housed in DAS really go forth even further. I use it as a reference point so often and a vision of what we can do and what we could be in terms of giving input and insight into current affairs and things that are happening the way, you know, the history department and DAS, you know, cross-listed faculty do very well. We had the flyering and the papering incident when people put racist flyers, and the way the, you know, history faculty, many of whom are jointly appointed with DAS, you know, really gave that historical context. I think DAS brings that context to so much of what's happening. If I'm visioning, I need, like, we've got Trotterhouse, but we need like just more centers. Like there needs to be like just more space for gathering and these conversations to happen. I think that the advocacy and activism around having the Trotterhouse on Central Campus is really important. Let's also have like that same kind of space at DAS, like a big gathering space, like more space for the community to come in, to kind of go almost to go forward, go back to go forward, mm-hmm. You know, where we do are able to pull community, you know, community and more have. I don't know if DAS has done many of the leveraged Coursera and some of the relationships that are happening there with the online offerings, but more of that,
It's mm-hmm. so funny you say that. I just did one with Seoul.
Yay!
With the movie. I did storytelling for it.
You know, to invite folks in to do, you know, more people in to do these micro courses and micro masters and micro, you know, there's so much that we learn from Zoom. And I know that, you know, Beth said, like, you know, pardon my ignorance if I don't know even more, but I just think that it's just so much to offer and just to continue and be given the resources and the everything that it needs. You know, I think, you know, I don't know how things are now, but I just, I think the university largely takes us for granted, probably. And I think that that probably hasn't changed. So I just think that they need to recognize DAS for the gift that it is to the university and invest in it and give it, you know, and so anything I can do to help make that possible. But yeah, it's my world would not be the same. My career would not be the same. My personal life. I mean, people always laugh at me like, you're always about U of M, you know? But when students say to me, they say, you know, well, there's not really many Black students at Michigan, so should I come here? I say, you are entitled to the resources that are here at this university. And there are people here to receive you and who have fought really hard. Everything good and right and righteous about this university came about because of student activism, much of it birthed from CAS, as CAS was birthed from activism. And so it's the gift, it's a real gift to this university, the years and years and years and the continued work and investment of, you know, hundreds of staff and students and faculty. And so I'm just really grateful for this institution, and I really look forward to the next 50 years.
Yay! I don't think we can do any better than that.
We took a whole journey.
Whole journey. What a journey. My goodness. So thank you so much. We appreciate you and really are so thankful that you were able to take some time to, I know how busy your schedule is and how you're continuing on your educational journey and on your life.
That was fun.
Oh, good. Oh, great. Great, great. So, you know, it's just amazing. And so we're looking forward to talking with more of our alumni from all different types of spaces. And so we wanted to start with you. So, yay. Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. If there's anything I need to clarify or any way I can be helpful, continue to be helpful, just let me know. It's such a pleasure to meet you. Is it Tara or Kara?
Tara.
And Ashley, thank you so much. And Beth, you know, it's always a pleasure.
Yay.
And yeah, I just wish you all the best. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Me. So lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Bye. Great. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. So I think I'll stop the recording and I think we got some good things, ladies.
Awesome things.
That was wonderful.